Good morning and welcome to Show 15 of Sci Radio. Joining me today is Professor Kamat from the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry. He is a highly decorated scientist who has ranked amongst the most cited researchers and has received numerous accolades for his groundbreaking work. Today we will be talking about his work on quantum dot solar cells and emerging technology in the world's push for clean energy. So without further ado, let's begin.
I would like to start off with your origin story. What got you interested in studying nanomaterials, and how did you get here to Notre Dame?
As you mentioned, I'm Prashant Kamat. I'm a professor of science at Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry and Radiation Laboratory, and I also work in concurrent professor in chemical and biomolecular engineering. And I joined Notre Dame in 1983. And at that time, the renewable energy was not that hot topic, but the Department of Energy was funding continuously. And I was lucky enough to be part of this fundamental research. And again, how you get started and interest is always an interesting story. I always refer to my childhood, where we didn't have any TVs, not many toys. You go out and play with your kids every day and try to explore the nature, and always the colored materials like leaves or flowers or butterflies, they always fascinated me. You know, like, what is these colors? They do. And as you're growing up, then you're looking at the trees and, you know, the photosynthesis where the leaves absorb sunlight and it gives us the food, which is carbohydrates. And you start wondering, you know, how come this nature does it so smartly? You do it. And that sort of initiates the early interest. But when I was doing my PhD thesis, there was an oil crisis that came in. That was, again, between the war between Israel and Egypt. And people took sides, and the U.S. was supporting the Israel. And as a result, the Arab countries put an embargo. And some senior, older people will remember there's gas lines. You know, people have to wait to get gasoline. And at that time, there was awareness came that we cannot just rely on fossil fuels and you need alternative energy. Jimmy Carter was the president here at the time, and he was very much into renewable energy. And he said, this is going to be the future and we need to invest in it. So that was sort of a first spark, and my PhD thesis involved studying this early part of this, we call it the photoelectrochemical cells, that is both light and electrochemistry involved. That is just like taking your battery cell and shining light to generate electricity. But that's a different type of batteries. But again, I want to show you that that is a national lab was sponsored called SERI, Solar Energy Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, Golden, Colorado, by Jimmy Carter. So now it is known as National Renewable Energy Laboratory. So just to give you just a background of how the renewable energy was sort of, especially fundamental research was supported or initiated here in the US in the 70s. And that has taken a long time. And in the 80s, the President Reagan came, and there the push was more on fossil fuels. The gasoline prices dropped down and everybody thought that the problem is over, and it lingered for a while. And today, the focus for renewable energy is not to provide a cheaper alternative, but a cleaner alternative. So as you can see, the force that drives the renewable energy changed. In 70s, it is to find an alternate source of energy. With that one, now it is to find a cleaner source of energy. So this is a very interesting thing. And even if 10 or 15 years back, if someone said renewable energy will be a part of energy mix, people would have laughed at you because it was so expensive. It is one of the most expensive part. But today, it is one of the cheaper alternative. The only cheaper one is natural gas. Wind is the next thing. So suppose if you want to put 100 megawatt power plant, wind and solar becomes cheaper compared to coal and nuclear. So this is, again, fact. So I just gave you some background of how my interest started in this. And then I came to Notre 83. So we started working on energy-related topics. So we were looking for a new type of molecules, a new type of materials, and that's how we started. And there were not too many research groups working on this one compared to what it is today. So it is now just exploded, this the area of research what we do.
A lot of your work focuses on photovoltaics. And could you give us an introduction of how photovoltaics work?
Yeah, this was done in 50s, working with silicon solar cell. Silicon, typically like carbon, it is not a semiconductor, okay? Typically, we are known two materials. For example, wood is an insulator, and whereas a copper or a wire is a conductor. So if you pass an electricity it passes through very quickly in copper wire. But in semiconductor is somewhere in between. So there is, if you give a little bit energy to these semiconductor materials, then they can become conducting. So that becomes a very important material. So this semiconductor, popularly known today with the silicon, that is a common thing. But silicon, pure silicon itself is not a semiconductor, but they put dopants like boron or phosphorus. So that way, there is a sites within the silicon where either it is electron deficient or electron excess. And based on that, it is called P or N-type materials. So that is the way the excess electron or holes gives a special property of semiconducting property for this silicon material. And it is a very controlled process. And today, the same process, there are other materials like semiconductors, like gallium arsenide. You have gallium phosphides. Then another class of materials called chalcogenides, like cadmium sulfide, cadmium telluride. So there are different type of materials, but most common ones are like gallium arsenide and silicon. And again, all your whether you're computers or it is photovoltaics or LED light bulbs, the semiconductors plays an important role. Just to give you steps is you apply an electric energy to make them active, whereas in photovoltaics you give light to make them active. So what happens is when they bring in N and P type silicon for a photovoltaic solar cell, they create a junction. And at the junction, there is a small field is created. So when you shine the light, we call it as the difference between where electrons flow and where electrons coming from. We call it as a conduction band and a valence band. So it is much easier. I could have seen it, but anyone can look into the Wikipedia about silicon and conduction band or valence band to get more familiarity with how happens. So when you shine the light, the electron just gets transferred from that valence band into conduction band. So that gets separated. So then it flows towards lower energy region, the electrons, and the holes move in opposite direction. So this is how the electricity is generated. So the light creates these electron hole pairs. They move in opposite direction at this PN junction. And with that one, you create light with this one. Interestingly, the LEDs work exactly the opposite way. That is, there you pass the electricity and create light. in photovoltaics, you shine the light and create electricity. So this is, I also give an example of a small fan. You pass electricity to run the fan. But if you take a big stick and start rotating that fan manually, you should be able to generate electricity. And that's how your small alternators on your bike or even the big hydroelectric plant or anywhere, they just run these big fans to generate electricity. So what I'm giving you is just an example how they are complementary, both between photovoltaics and LED. In one case, you make light to electricity. And in the case of LEDs, you make electricity into light.
As of my understanding, we used to have more of these photovoltaics that are based on like silicon and like gallium arsenide, and we're trying to move towards more quantum dot solar cells.
Yeah, right. What happened was, again, the semiconductor, we call them as a bulk materials. In the bulk material, what we have is it has certain properties. But imagine you start breaking down into small pieces, right? Make it 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8, 8 to 16 kind of a thing, and just make it very, very, very small. Then they become so small, you can't even see from your eyes. So that approach is called top-down approach. The bottom-up approach is you take small molecules and trying to put together and make materials. And then you can control size. And these small materials, typically they are of the size of nanometers, anywhere from 10 to 100 nanometers, or even a couple of hundred nanometers. They are called nanomaterials. Nano stands for 10 to the minus 9 meter, nanometer. Okay. So just to give you an idea, the human hair is about 50 micron, that is 10 to the minus 6. So you divide that by another thousandth of a size of a human hair, then it is in the nanometer region. So that gives you an idea that why you cannot see these nanomaterials by such. But they do have color, they can absorb light, they can emit light. So we can see those properties from these nanomaterials. These materials were in existence long before they were called nanomaterials. They were commonly referred as colloidal particles or ultra-fine particles, or they're different. They were in catalysis, they were in medicines, they were in a variety of paints, variety of applications, these particles, small particles were there. The only thing is that they didn't call nanomaterials. Only in the late 80s and 90s, the word nano became very popular, and that's how they started nanomaterials. But again, there were also a lot of understanding of the properties that came in the same time in the 80s and 90s, which were not known before. And one of the property of the nanomaterial is called quantization effect or size quantization effect. That means that their properties depend on the size. So just to give an idea that one of the common material like lead sulfide or cadmium selenide, the bulk, they are pretty dark color. But in this, as you decrease the size, they become more visible light absorbing, or their energy for their transition between valence and conduction band increases. So this size dependent property of, we call it the band gap, is a unique to the size quantization effect. So these are commonly referred as quantum dots or quantized nanoparticle, where there is a clear dependence on the size. People have moved on to it, making called quantum wells or two-dimensional materials. So they also show quantum size effects because a single layer of graphene or molybdenum sulfide behaves differently than a bulk graphite. So there are various properties. And one of the things we started working was with these quantum dot particles and how we can use their varying property in solar cells. And we started this in the 90s, and it continued for a while in that direction. Again, this area has developed quite a bit. Again, as I said, what we started in 1980s, and then it led to what they call the disensitized solar cells. Then came organic solar cells. Then came quantum dot solar cells. Today, one of the most popular one in the same line is called perovskite solar cell. It's again a semiconductor material. These are what they call metal halide perovskites. It contains mostly lead or tin and a halide like iodide, bromide, or chloride. And then there is another one which is azide cation, which they call it as either methyl ammonium, formamidium, or cesium. So any combination of these three elements, that is the cation, which is methyl ammonium, formamidium, cesium, and lead or tin, and then halide, gives you a very interesting semiconductor. And this has now become the one of the most studied currently for solar cell. And the reason is it has now can compete with the existing silicon solar cell in terms of efficiency. And the people are trying to now use this material to combine with silicon, and they call it the tandem solar cell. And that has now efficiency superseding the single junction solar cell. So this is where things are going right now.
And for some reference, could you what efficiency does a silicon solar cell have? And okay. What does a newer solar cell have?
Yeah. First of all, what is the efficiency we are talking and why it is important? As you know, if you are putting a solar cell on a rooftop, right? So your area is fixed. And if you want to extract electricity when sun shines, you want to get the maximum power from those same area. So the higher the efficiency of the solar cell for the same area, it will get more power. Typically the sunlight has 100 milliwatt per centimeter square, and that's the one sun people always take care of it. So if you have a say 20% cell, so you can draw 20 milliwatt per centimeter square of electricity when the sun shines. And typical in the household, you need for a day about 5 to 6 kilowatt hour consumption. So typically if you have, I would say 1500 square feet or 2000 square feet area of a solar top roof panel, it can provide you the enough electricity for the house. So now coming back to your question, okay, what are the current efficiencies? So there are two types of efficiencies. One is what they call lab certified efficiencies. Like people like us, when you make in the lab, we take a very small area of the things, like maybe a centimeter square or a tenth of a centimeter square to make a solar cell. But that gives you a record efficiency in the lab. So for silicon, it's about 26.2%. For perovskite solar cell, it is 25.5%. For organic solar cell, it is about 18%. And same thing with the quantum dot solar cell, also 18%. The other solar cells range anywhere between 20 to 30% or 26% range in this one. So if you are going to say, space, putting on a space shuttle or somewhere this or a satellite, a solar panel, there, the area is in the prime demand. So there, the cost is not a factor. So once you start boosting efficiency, the cost goes up. So for the space flight, the efficiencies can range. They have what they call multi-junction solar cells, where it can range anywhere to 40 to 45%. So they want to maximize. Those efficiencies, again, I said lab certified efficiencies. But what happens in the commercial, when you make large panels, their efficiencies start dropping. And today, the one that goes on your rooftop is probably around 15%. Even if it goes to like 18% and 20%, the cost jumps significantly. So manufacturers, what they do is when they make these things, they sort it out. You know, just like if you have picked apples from a farm, you know, the best nice shaped and good ones you separate out, and then the medium category and then the low category, so that the pricing goes based on the quality. Same way in the silicon, solar cells, photovoltaics, it goes on the efficiency of the solar cells, the pricing. So the pricing can vary based on the efficiency, and for a simple reason, because for the same area, you can get more power out of the cells.
Cool. There are currently three viable configurations of quantum dot solar cells. Could you like go through each of them and then explain to us like what constitutes each configuration?
Yeah, again, when we started, this was an old one. As I said, the quantum dots things have moved away into now into perovskite solar cells. But the initially, when we started, the three types was one is just on a plane. You had to create a heterojunction, just like you create a PN junction. Typically, you have to bring in another semiconductor. So we used to use like titanium dioxide or zinc oxide or tin oxide. So that material, that is one thing. Otherwise, one can also use a polymer base, polymer and quantum dots, those things. The other could be existing semiconductor and you trying to create a multi-junction or a tandem type solar cell. So again, these are initially comes as a more, what do you call, academic curiosity. You know, the research most of the time comes as a more of a child play, in the sense that you let your mind wander through and say, okay, what can I do with this material? How can I make them more better or efficient? And you have to try several different approaches. And I'll tell you, 4 out of 5 doesn't work, okay? You think that it might work, but one of them clicks. And that's when it gives that utmost satisfaction. And then you can build on that kind of a thing, trying to improvise and make it better and those kind of a things. So as I said earlier, we initially just started with a dye-sensitized solar cell. Instead of a semiconductor quantum dot, they use a dye molecule, which was used in photography and other places, same principle. But now you have these quantum dots came and replaced. And now, instead of quantum dot, people are using these metal halide perovskites. And in some sense, they all operate on the same principle, but they do differ in other properties.
Okay, and our time is slowly coming to an end. So I have one question just like about the general future of where you see photovoltaics heading. The United States seems to be like heading in a renewed direction of more investment and research into alternative forms of energy. And so what is your team looking forward to studying now and into the future?
Yeah, you know, the one thing is gratifying in my life. It's not that I have done it or something, but something I believed in, that one day renewable energy will be an energy source. It has come to reality. That is, for me, it is a big fulfilling in terms of seeing it happen. So what we have done in terms of research is like a drop in a bucket, okay? So one person doesn't make a change. It is the entire community puts together. And it took a long time for business people, industrial people, even the oil companies to realize there is a money to make. Okay, that is from my perspective. Your question is regarding what is the current status and what is future. Renewable energy is a three-pronged or a three-legged stool, okay? So one leg is capturing the light because you need some material to capture. So you need to develop these new materials that can do better than existing material. The second part is you need to convert into the light into electricity or light into some kind of a chemical fuels. So I didn't talk about it. There is also a lot of push and research going on, right, in terms of making chemical fuels, because we need fuel for a lot of applications. And one of them considered is a hydrogen. So we have plenty of water. We have plenty of light. So what you need is that magic pixie dust where you can throw in water and make hydrogen, right? So that is a challenge we have. So already they are talking about hydrogen economy, building infrastructure based on hydrogen. So even with the photovoltaic panels, you can split water. You can use an electrolyzer and do it. So that is one area you see in future taking over in terms of solar fuels. Third one is energy storage. One of the things that often comes to your mind is what happens if it is a cloudy day here what happens in the nighttime? So how are you going to do it? So that's where the storage batteries come into play. And the storage batteries also have done a remarkable thing coming back in the electric vehicles. Today, car companies, GM, Ford, any name it, they all investing in electric vehicles. So which means we need a lot of storage batteries. And interestingly, what is happening is now they call it as a repurposing electrical vehicle batteries. That means that when after about 8 or 10 years, the batteries in your car drops in performance. At that time, they take out the battery and replace it. But these batteries are not dead. They have a lot of juice in it. So now they want to use these batteries for solar energy storage. That means a rooftop. So you can buy of these batteries, and they're typically lithium-ion batteries, and you can store energy and run it in the night. So next morning you can charge again. So the prices of these storage batteries is dropping down tremendously. So that is another area that is there. And there is one more area where the society is reaping the benefit is LEDs, okay? That is also part of the mix in the sense that previous incandescent light bulbs, they used to have, they were mostly heat bulbs. The 90% was heat and maybe 5 to 10% used to be light. Today, LED bulbs, they don't generate heat. You can go and touch a LED bulb. It is not very hot. So it's mostly light. So they are 60, 70% efficient. So the whole world is now changing from incandescent bulb to LEDs. And we are saving a lot of energy. When you save energy, we are also saving. Imagine all those carbon going into the atmosphere, now we are reducing it. So if you see the carbon footprint coming out of the energy in the US, it is pretty flat or declining. And that's mainly because of the lighting display, because lighting takes an enormous amount of things. So all these changes are happening right in front of our eyes, and they are going to continue to dominate whether we endorse it or we sort of see it, but it is becoming part of it. I don't think even if somebody gives you an incandescent bulb free, you know, sometime I go to the hardware store and see these free light bulbs, nobody even buying them. The reason is the society likes to have these LED light bulbs because they're brighter, they consume low electricity. So this is where we are standing and we are changing. And same way, now people who used to complain about wind and solar, the utility companies are now putting it in. So these changes are going to dominate in the coming decade. And one of the goal of the new administration is to have net zero emission. That means we are going to develop this energy with no additional carbon output in the atmosphere. So I think that is going to be a major part, the climate change that will drive the renewable energy.
Wow, so that's a lot of prospects. The last one about the LEDs one was really interesting. I remember like when I was growing up, all of the Christmas decorations, they were incandescent bulbs, and now they're all LEDs. So I suppose like a
Notre Dame Stadium or anywhere else, even you go to, like, I go to country like India and everywhere, all the street lamps are now LEDs.
Yeah.
They're bright and very efficient. Mm-hmm. And countries like in India, the government gives free LED bulbs to people because that saves them a lot of energy, and that becomes the power load on the grid comes lowers quite a bit.
Wow, okay. So my last question for you is, what is a misconception that people often have about your field of work, and what should it actually be?
You know, again, there is a disconnect definitely between things like chemistry and the real world. People think chemistry means it's a chemical pollution. You know, that's a thing comes in my mind, but people forget that everything we use is a chemical. The thing is that is there is a lot of good practices going on right now, and most of the pollutions are part of carelessness on behalf of somebody, and which is not happening that much now. Just to give an example, like medicine is a chemical. All your cleaning dishes is a chemical. Other day I was in one of the stores and somebody picked up a detergent with no perfumes or no it says, and the guy says, oh, this is a good one. There is no chemicals inside. And I didn't tell him, but I felt like telling him, well, the detergent is a chemical. Okay, so anything you pick and use, it is a chemical. Your salt is a chemical, sodium chloride, right? So sometimes some of them are occurring naturally and some of them we make them. So that is the thing, the misconception is, don't be get scared of chemistry. Chemistry is an important part, whether it is in energy, medicine, or you're creating new materials for life. Another example I always give is the computers. All the credit goes to the software engineers who develop these apps and, oh, this cool app that's coming in, right? But just look at inside your computer. Everything is made up of a new material, right? So someone has to make those materials in the lab, study their properties, and make it goes into your computer. The inside, every part that you see is a chemical. And that is the heart of the computer. For example, the batteries, you know, the lithium ion battery, you take away the battery, your phone is like a paperweight. There is no, will not work. And that is a chemistry. And people are trying to make it. And then people say, why can't I make it fast charging? Again, the reason is it is a chemistry that requires slower charging. Otherwise, it will short and catch fire. So there are a lot of things in this one. Even in modern cars, you know, they will put so many different bells and whistles and computers and all those things. Ultimately, what hasn't changed in 150 years is the lead acid battery. Every car has a lead acid battery that is 150 year old. And that technology has not changed. Isn't it interesting?
Yeah. Wow. That is insane.
Yeah. And you take out the battery, your car won't run. You can't even start your car.
Well, thank you for coming on today, Professor.
Okay, and good luck with your studies and everything. Again, you can send me the link and I will forward it.